Hi, and welcome to the Integrative Women's Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jessica Drummond, and I am so thrilled to have you here as we dive into today's episode. As always, innovating and integrating in the world of women's health. And just as a reminder, the content in this podcast episode is no substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment from your medical or licensed healthcare team. While myself and many of my guests are licensed healthcare professionals, we are not your licensed healthcare professionals. So you want to get advice on your unique circumstances, diagnostic recommendations, treatment recommendations from your home medical team. Enjoy the episode. Let's innovate and integrate together. Today, I have a very special guest for the Integrative Women's Health Podcast. Hi there, I'm Dr. Jessica Drummond. I'm your host, and today we're going to be meeting Federica. She is here to share her story as a case study for you to learn how we navigate complex chronic illness, such as endometriosis in her case, through the health coaching lens, how we integrate her multidisciplinary team and her day-to-day health behaviors to help her overcome and live healthfully, even in the midst of having a complex chronic illness, endometriosis, and recovering from complex excision surgery, skilled excision surgery for her endometriosis. So join me in listening in and look out for the step-by-step of our seven-step system for how we work with any women's health, chronic or acute illnesses that we're collaborating with our clients through that coaching mindset, coaching perspective, and, you know, coaching integration into their actual life, not just giving them a list of things to do to get well, but really integrating it within her life, her vision, her values. So let's dive in. Oh, and remember, while I am a licensed clinical nutritionist and licensed physical therapist and board certified health and wellness coach, I am not yours of any of those. And so take this as general information for your own health. Please follow the recommendations of your own clinical or coaching health team, wellness team, and don't delay any therapies with them due to any educational materials that you might hear on this podcast. If you would like to apply to be a guest case study on our podcast, please send an email to support@integrativewomenshealthinstitute.com. That's support@integrativewomenshealthinstitute.com. And just simply put in the subject line, application to be a case study on your podcast. Let's dive in. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Jessica Drummond, your host of the Integrative Women's Health Podcast, and I'm here today with Federica. She has come to give us her story of her own healing to show you how, as a women's health or wellness coach, you can be approaching these more complex cases. So we're going to lead with a coaching mindset, and we're going to integrate various clinical strategies, which you can employ depending on your licensure in your state or your country, and also just your level of training. So for example, we know that physical therapists in the United States can utilize nutrition strategies for healing things related to the physical therapy diagnosis, assuming they have the level of functional nutrition training to do that, because it's not always offered in our entry level, you know, physical therapy licensure training. So that's one example. If you're a nutritionist, a dietitian, gynecologist, functional medicine practitioner, any of the letters behind your name, you'll be able to use some of these tools. And for others of you, if you're fully leading with the coaching mindset, whether or not you have any other letters behind your name, you're always still doing this in an educational model, because what we want is that our clients, so in this case, Federica, is going to be actively engaged in the process. This is not going to be me telling her, okay, you have to do X, Y, and Z, and that's going to solve your problem, because this is very much an interactive experience. All right. So thank you and welcome. Thank you for being here. And Federica, could you start us off with sharing the story of when you last felt well, and then what's been going on with you physically for the last few years?
Yeah, absolutely. So the memory about me feeling well for more than a few days, it goes back to, I think, more than 10 years ago. I think before I moved to the US, because I'm originally from Italy, born and raised. And 1 year after I moved to the US, I started having debilitating pain with my period. And keep in mind that before, when I was in Italy, I had some symptoms around sexuality. So I had some pain with sex, mainly urinary symptoms, but I never had an issue with my period. And so in the last 12 years, my symptoms have been very unpredictable. I had entire years where I was more or less fine, but I've always had lots of unexplainable periods of very strong GI symptoms. And it meant having lots of pain, going to the bathroom, becoming all of a sudden constipated, even functionally constipated, like my system shutting down. And so it has been a very traumatic journey, because I went around for 12 years with no one even mentioning endometriosis really as a word. And I tried really everything. I am a learner at core. So this is the reason why 1 year ago, I actually studied at the Integrative Women's Health Institute, trying to become my first patient, my first client in a way. And I've been using lots of tools in my toolset: pelvic floor therapy, changing nutrition, supplementation, regulating nervous system. But the last year and a half has been the hardest in my entire history. It became a continuum. I didn't have one day of not feeling excruciating pain. And so it has been a year where they tried lots of things on me, lots of hormones, and things went down the hill. Finally, in December last year, after 12 years of going around the world, I finally found an endometriosis specialist. And so I had skilled excision surgery last October. And my life has improved. I try not to have attachment to the outcome of the surgery. I have to say it is improved, but still, I don't have a great quality of life. So I am definitely trying to learn as much as I can about anything else I might be doing.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. So it's been a little more than a decade, 12 years since you moved from Italy. About a year later, you started having period pain. Possibly had active endo even in Italy, but the symptoms were much lighter and mostly post-sexual urinary symptoms. So finally, after a lot of GI symptoms, period pain, you know, coming and learning what endometriosis was from us, and a few of your, finally, some of your practitioners started to say and put endometriosis, you had excision surgery in October of 2023, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And I think this is a really important point. So October of 2023, we're now in early February 2024. So it's only been 4 months-ish. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I think many people don't realize, and people are often not prepared for if they do have endometriosis surgery, is two things. It's very helpful, and it sounds like you did some of this, but by then your symptoms were really wound up. To have physical therapy and nutrition and coaching, counseling pre-surgically, usually for 3 to 6 months, with the goal being to settle the nervous system activation, which is a lot of times easier said than done and can take some pretty intensive coaching and work and down training. And it depends on what else is going on in your life, which we'll get into that in a minute. But ideally, we want to be as low inflammatory, calm, and relaxed about the surgery as possible. Is that easy to do? No, it's very difficult, because most people, like you, have had a decade of medical trauma and constant extreme symptoms. And it's also frustrating because we often don't know, and there are some technologies in the works to try to have better diagnostics for endometriosis that are not so invasive. But the reality is, at the current moment, to be diagnosed with endometriosis, you have to have surgery. That's the only real way to know for sure whether or not you have endometriosis. Now, if they do see it on imaging, then you have it. So that in some ways can be calming because it's like, finally, okay, I have a thing to put this on. But most people go into surgery, and tell us if this was your experience, not knowing whether or not you actually have endometriosis.
Yeah, so that's why I like to say that endometriosis is the upside down world, because you wake up from the surgery hoping that they found something. And in my case, they could see some fibrosis in the MRI. So it was pretty suggestive that a deep infiltrating process going on, but they didn't see, of course, the extent. So my experience was that when I woke up, I kept on asking, did you find it? And the surgeon was like, yes. And he gave me the entire footage, and it was very healing for me, even if it seems weird that you want to see that. But definitely, I didn't know for certain the extent, what they would have found. They can find also like endometriomas. They could find some things that are also not great, and they might have to remove part of you. So yeah, it's a huge, huge question mark. It takes a big toll to go there.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a little bit too. So you go into surgery, like many people, with that question mark. You had strong suspicion because of the MRI and some of the imaging, which is a little bit affirming. Then you come out and you're like, okay, this is real. It has a name. It's something people understand to some extent. And in your case, it was very severe. Stage 4, deep infiltrating endo in the bowel, or where?
It was not infiltrating in the intramural of the bowel. It was deep fibrosis of the pelvis. So it was not a frozen pelvis, but close to it. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So all over the pelvis, pelvic organs, soft tissues, fascia. And we're going to come back to that word fascia in a little bit, because it's part of the nervous system regulation. We think of the brain as being the nervous system, but really there's all of these peripheral nerves in the fascia that are a key part of the conversation. All right. So if we back up a bit to just before the surgery, and even a few years before the surgery, one of the reasons why I said it's easier said than done to just have this calming, you know, my guess was you weren't laying on a beach in Fiji for the year before your surgery.
I wish.
What were you doing? What was your life like? Yeah.
I had a very similar conversation with my best friend. This is why I'm laughing. So the year before has been a very pivotal year for me, because I've been working in tech. I have a scientific background. I was a researcher before, and then I worked in tech for 10 years, and I had a very, very stressful, super high profile, very stressful position. And I came to the decision to leave it last January, actually, 2023. There were also some things happening in that company, but also I was not in a good state to do it. And also I really needed to look for my purpose, because I wanted to serve another kind of mission. And so I took 1 year off work, and my year definitely didn't look like being at the Fijis. People are like, oh, so cool, you had the sabbatic year. I was in so much pain. They tried multiple hormonal approaches on me, and I had rashes, gained tons of weight. I was sad all the time, like progesterone, really, like big doses of progesterone too, don't do well to my brain. But in all of this, being a very learning-oriented person, I wanted to give a meaning to this time. And I didn't do it consciously. I realize it now, but I studied at your school. I studied while coaches as a health and wellness coach. I started a yoga teacher training. I know it sounds crazy, but I really started pivoting so that my pain could become meaningful and I could just do something for others too. And so I started doing advocacy. So it's definitely been a intense year, not a happy one, but I found a lot of meaning. And now I can appreciate it. When I was in the midst of it, I have been at my worst. I really went in cocoon. I wasn't really going out or being, I was really like in my pain body, but it was a lot.
Yeah, no, that's very valuable, because I think one of the things that's so common about your story is that, so one, it's valuable that you had the opportunity to be able to leave that stressful job. But also, that was what your body was just kind of used to. That was your schedule. That was where you learned to mask the pain and the symptoms and keep it together for work, which, while isn't ideal and on many levels, it's one level of control over the situation. And, you know, I know, having had a really complex experience with long COVID, I too, and many people do, try two things. One, sometimes work is an anchor that can keep you at least stable because you have to keep kind of showing up. So there's some benefit to that. If you have the opportunity to leave a high pressure situation and take care of yourself, that's also valuable. But I think a lot of times no one tells you how to do that. And so what we often do, and I did the same thing early in my long COVID journey, is I became like the education chair of the long COVID physio thing. You know, I was trying to give talks, we were trying to put together a conference and have advocacy work. There's danger in that. And I was able to see it pretty quickly for myself because of my experience for 25 years working with people with endometriosis and vulvodynia and other really severe chronic pain issues. The benefit is you have a community that does kind of understand what you're going through at many levels. So they believe you. They don't think you're crazy. They know this pain is real. They know these symptoms are real. But it keeps you identified with the disease. And so after about 6 months of realizing I just didn't have the capacity to do that, and it sounds like you learned a lot of skills and you learned a lot of meaning, and there's real value in that, but it doesn't actually help the symptoms in many cases. Is that what your experience was?
Yeah, I have to say that I noticed, especially social media for me, are very difficult because my brain is a very fast-paced brain, and social media, I mean, I think can be like this for everyone, but my experience is that it gets under my skin. And especially in the account of the coaching practice that I started for women with endo, of course, the content that comes up is always about endo. And I really feel it, that I can take it up to a point and then it becomes obsessive. Like, I feel again that that's all my life. And so I try to implement strategies, for example, being on social media only on Tuesday, right? The other piece is the support groups. It's true, it's a double-sided sword, right? Because it gave me lots of support, but also I end up in that very obsessive, oh my God, oh my God. Being also an empath, when these people share their pain, it's like it's reopening up mine constantly. And so definitely is difficult. The part that gives me energy still is the advocacy piece in terms of going and speaking at a conference. I'm trying to help, for example, the group, the Center for Endo here in Boston that did my surgery, because I'm incredibly grateful. And so that gives me energy because that also brings my scientist side. I can do research. But yeah, the other things, I agree. I would agree that too much is not allowing me to remember that also I have a life.
Yeah. And so I think this is something that each individual has to navigate a bit for themselves, because what's hard about this is, of course, if you aren't in the world of chronic illness or you're not a clinician of endometriosis, in which case you're very busy all day with endometriosis patients or a coach of endometriosis, or you have endometriosis or the family member of an endometriosis patient, who's going to do the advocacy, right? Like, some of us have to. Same thing with any chronic illness. So there's that. So I think a big bow of gratitude for people who do sacrifice some level of their own health to do this work for others in that situation. And then I think it's just important to have some awareness of this so that you can make a decision about that with almost like true informed consent. Because a lot of times we're just sort of thrown into it rather than being like, oh, wait a minute. You know, at one point you said just a minute ago, it was getting under my skin. Like, it was physically harmful for you and emotionally harmful for you to carry the pain of so many other people while you're not really in a stable place yet. Like, you're trying to get ready for surgery, right? So I think it's all of us have to make these very subtle decisions for how much or how little and when the timing is right. And so if you're listening to this and your patients are struggling with endometriosis, but you don't have it, you're very stable, or some of them are on the other side and are very stable and are feeling really well, maybe that's the place to do some advocacy. And I think it's very important that from a coaching mindset, you put some boundaries around that. Even if it's, you know, yes, you can absolutely have an endometriosis social media account on Tuesdays only.
The Tuesday social.
That's right. And maybe we agree, like once a week is the max anyone can be expected to be on a chronic illness social media. And I think whatever the boundaries are that feel right for you. And that time just before surgery, coming back to this as a clinical example, is a really valuable time for people to create like a nest of safety and support, because you're building that pre-surgical and post-surgical nest. So some of the things that I use are some homeopathic strategies to start settling the nervous system. There is an array of tools that we can all use: breath work, mindfulness, slow movement practices. There's probably some real benefit in you doing a yoga training. And maybe thinking of it as just training for yourself as the only client, and then later use it for others. And it sounds like you were really doing that, which is great. So yoga is not for everyone. Some people just need to be sitting with their dogs. Some people need to be outside a lot. Some people need to be on the phone with friends. Everyone is going to have different quality strategies for regulating the nervous system. So that's a really important piece. And then also pre-surgically, what you were trying to do, I think, is lower your inflammation in a number of different ways. And we'll get into the details of what we want to do now, but that's also good. Then you have your surgery and post-op. So one of the things I want to circle back to is your 4-month post. And it's very normal to just get over the acute pain of surgery in about 6 to 12, 18 weeks. So you're just through the early acute recovery. It's very normal to have a full recovery from surgery that takes 6 to 24 months.
Okay, I feel better. I'm going to make a note here because this is not what they tell you all the time. You know?
Yeah, this is not what they tell you, but what they didn't take into consideration. So if in an ideal world, you were in Fiji for 10 years, you were like, oh, I have endo. Very few symptoms. You go into surgery, they take it all out. I mean, your nervous system and your immune system, which is part of the driver of all these secondary symptoms, and your digestive system, which has been infiltrated by essentially scar tissue and fascial adhesions and all of that for years, if not decades, just springs right back. A lot of times in functional medicine, we talk about how instead of, let's say someone steps on a nail, instead of giving them Advil and massages and stuff, we take the nail out, right? But that's not always possible. And in endo, I think of the endo as the nail. And for most people, if their endo becomes activated, it can become activated at any point in their life. But in many people, that's, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. And for you, it might have been very subtly active in Italy 15 years ago, but you had a lifestyle and food access and things that was much less inflammatory than being in the United States. So it didn't fully activate, but you had some level of the nail in your foot for 15 years. You can't just take it out. There's going to be response from the nervous system, from the immune system. There'll be bleeding. There'll be scar tissue. If that nail was in your colon or in your pelvis, it's going to also impact certain organs that you don't have in your foot. So it's not as simple as just take the nail out. So they took the nail out, but it leaves behind scar tissue, immune upregulation, or I would say immune dysregulation, because you're both overreacting to certain things and not always able to clear viruses and pathogens, and gut microbiome gets messed up and your nervous system gets messed up and all that. So now that's why I think it's really important, while the surgical wounds might be healed and you're not bleeding, there's no complications, now we have to work on all the systems. So I've been saying for 20 years, don't chase symptoms, optimize systems. Now we just are barely able to start doing that because you're only 4 months out. We're just now, the acute surgical wounds have healed. Is that helpful?
Yeah. The thing is, after surgery, even if you are working with a team that is incredibly skilled, of course, the information that the surgical team gives you is that in 8 weeks, you can do twists. I've been working with the functional medicine doctor too in parallel, and I saw the difference between perspectives where I didn't know up to 24 months. So this gives me even more hope, but it's definitely, the wound is one thing, but the system is definitely a longer process.
Yeah. And in a way, 6 to 24 months even is kind of arbitrary. Like if you've been dealing with this for 30 years, we're increasingly seeing people dealing with endo diagnoses in their perimenopause and perimenopause timeframe in their 40s and 50s. You know, you've been dealing with this for 30 years without even knowing it, perhaps. So whatever the timeframe was before, it's kind of like when we talk about recovery postpartum, 9 months in, 9 months out, you don't bounce back in 6 weeks when you have your follow-up appointment. All right. But I also think healing is an upward spiral, right? It's a journey where now what we can start to be looking for is starting to have some improvements that are maybe not every single day, but some days that are feeling better, some good days, some less intense days. But it's not going to happen on its own because of all of the other dysregulation that you went into surgery with and that the surgery itself could flare up. So let's start talking about those systems. So if you think about your nervous system and regulation, how is that feeling to you now? And what are the tools that you're finding most helpful for that?
Definitely in the last 6 months since I started my yoga teacher training, that gave me access to a lot of breathing techniques and even just the yoga practice. I'm very interested to the fascia when you mentioned it. And so I've been really working with this. I've been monitoring my HRV, for example, to really understand, oh, I feel very tired. And look, it's actually like, I mean, I have a Fitbit and I don't have anything too fancy, but I started trying to not overcharge my system because I tend to be a super enthusiastic person. So as soon as I got out of the surgery, I was like, okay, I need my life back. So I'm pretty regulated. I have very strong mood swings. And this IUD, it's a conscious decision that I came to with the team that's working with me because I also have adenomyosis and I'm not ready to have an hysterectomy unless it's strictly necessary. So I don't have a true like strong period, but I still have ovulation and my mood really spikes. And so there are a couple of days a month or more that I am more dysregulated. My dysregulation is very much hormonal, I have to say. So yeah, progress. I do cold showers, for example, tapping, acupuncture. Like, yeah, I really dedicated lots of time to these things now that I can before going back full on to a full-time job.
Yeah. So a couple of lessons, a couple of insights. If you can take some time post-op to do that true healing, maybe ease in part-time, maybe take some time off, easier said than done, depending on what your family's situation and financial situation and support system. But the more you can, that's really, really valuable. And then what we mean when we say nervous system regulation, there are three states of the nervous system. There's fight or flight, that's sympathetic upregulation where you're kind of always on, anxious, jittery, overwhelmed. You know, you're literally want to either fight or flight. Or there's freeze state, which is a parasympathetic autonomic nervous state, which is that more healing state, but the activation of a certain part of your vagus nerve keeps you in a freeze state, which is actually an abnormal state. So imagine you just got in a car accident or something and you have a broken arm and it's really painful, but you can't get out of that car. You have to wait for someone to get you out. Something's on your arm or something like that. You're not dying, but you're in intense discomfort. Your body is going to stop and put you in kind of a frozen state so you can tolerate that for however long you have to sit there. And that's one of the reasons why work is a bit of a blessing and a curse. Like it might keep you in sort of a frozen enough state that you can shut down some of the symptoms in your nervous system, some of the sensation of the symptoms, but it's also maladaptive and you're not healing in that state. So freeze state, you'll know it by like, can't motivate, tired, low energy, too anxious to do anything. You're kind of stuck, depressed sometimes. So when you're having those mood swings, that could be in the freeze state. And then there's ventral vagus activation, which is what we really want. That's the calm state of aliveness. So you feel there and awake and alert and engaged and relaxed. That's the healing state. So you can be completely at rest. You can be interacting with people and feeling relaxed. But that's a challenging state for most people to get into these days. And that between jobs and pandemics and terrible news cycles and social media doom scrolling, and then you layer on just having had a surgery after a decade-long chronic illness, practicing staying in ventral vagus, calm aliveness, that healthy parasympathetic state takes a lot of work. So as you said, you know, acupuncture, yoga, breath work, you know, nature, movement, tapping, being mindful of how other interventions knock you out of that ventral state. For example, being on hormonal suppression like birth control or Lupron or Alessa. So noticing that is step one, and then finding the tools that work for you. And like I said, we do all of these things. We do homeopathy. We do just exposure to nature, slow walking, Pilates, you know, there's movement ways, there's hugs, petting your dog.
Hugs are great.
Yeah, sometimes it's oxytocin, you know, replacement therapy, if you will. So there's lots of things that we can do even directly. Like you can literally shoot oxytocin up your nose if you need to. There's nasal sprays, there's troches.
I didn't know that. Okay. <That's->
Yeah. So there's things you can dissolve in your mouth that gives you oxytocin, but you can also get it from hugs and connection and dogs and cats and guinea pigs and whatever. So I think that what's really valuable is you've discovered a lot of those tools and you're actively using them. One thing that's important to remind everybody is that you can know 1,000 tools intellectually, but if you choose just one and do it most days, that's going to be better.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's so true. Before the surgery, when I was very anxious about it, and like I was trying to do everything because I was like, oh my God. And I was like, come on, you're a scientist. You know that if we change all variables, then we can't see what was that worked. And so then I was like, Fede, okay. So now I'm using more of it, like, okay, yeah. Because as my yoga teacher says, sometimes more is not better, it's just more. So I'm trying to just, it's a good perspective.
All right. So your nervous system, which is kind of where we start. So we have a 7-step system in our mindset strategy is like where we start is getting everything regulated because nothing else works as well unless we're in that state as often as we can, knowing we're going to fall out of it several times every day, and that's fine. The key is just keep coming back there. Then the next step is we want to see what is your real goal. So there are some certain key priorities, areas of discomfort, but if you could imagine your life in a year from now, 6 months from now, whatever time frame you want to give it, what would your vision and goals be?
Yeah, I think, or I feel is better to say, not being in constant fear of what the day is going to bring. Because my life now has very good days, but I have so much grief for all the life that I, in a way, lost, and also the suffering, that it's enough that I wake up and I don't go to the bathroom well, and I start feeling my nerve pain and all of that, that I really, as you said, I really shift very, very, very fast to this pool of sadness. That's not dangerous per se. I'm not saying, oh no, I mean, I'm going to jump the window or anything. It's just that it really takes a big toll. I don't believe that my goal would be to see myself like always like happy with no problems, just trusting this body, especially after all of this, after all the validation that the disease was there. Definitely, I'm having more compassion for my body, but especially because I have this IUD and I don't feel myself, even like the libido side of things, I don't feel my body. And so I'm trying to see if I can regain that feeling, not dissociated and feeling in, and maybe it's different than before. I mean, I don't think it serves me to say I want to feel exactly how I was feeling when I was 19. But I think not in pain, waking up and say, oh, I have all energy to face my day, and feeling good in my body, just like, oh, you're cute this morning kind of thing.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think it's really important that we address that fear and grief piece, because again, when your surgical team says to you, you're going to be ready to go in 8 weeks, you can do Pilates, you can run, you can do whatever you want. But if you have been with something, managing something, navigating something for 12 years, and it was really hard and it took a toll on you and it was exhausting and exhausted your family and friends, and you also lost that time. So how old are you now? Do you mind sharing with us?
No, I'm 41.
41. So 19, you felt great. 41, you're starting to come back to yourself. That's two decades that you kind of missed. And we should be creating space for you to heal and grieve. You know, I mean, I feel the same way. You missed years of your life when you live in these chronic illness states. And you didn't totally miss it. You know, you've had some great work experiences. You've got a great partner. You've got things in your life that are great. So I think we always have to be comfortable with the fact that grief and things being great can be in the same two hands at the same time.
It's so true, especially because of my training as scientific training. And also plus like my personality, I grew up is either or. And the biggest teaching for me actually, and we are so aligned today, it's exactly this end. It's like, oh, things are going better and I still have pain. And in my mind, the two things couldn't be, because after this surgery, in a way, if the surgery worked, then I should be feeling okay. And actually, no, it's an end. So it's, I think for everyone listening, this end piece, I hope it resonates, because it's very, very key.
Yeah. So you're on the upward spiral of healing, which means that you're having more better days. And some days, maybe around ovulation, maybe when you have a rough, who knows what you ate the day before or what stresses you were under the day before or whatever, that you have a little rough morning bowel movement, that you can quickly shift into fear and grief. And what's one of the words that's known in this kind of pain science is catastrophization, where you start thinking this is going to be forever. And that's a normal response, because those pathways are well traveled in your brain for you to be like, oh no, this is forever. And then your mood gets all over. Whereas you can say, you know what? This is literally right now. I'm in discomfort, but this bowel movement is going to pass in a few minutes. And then I have the capacity to feel better. Maybe it's 2 points less pain. Maybe it's 10 points less pain. We won't know until then. So that slowing down of the healing and knowing that it is very variable for these first several months, for sure, I hope feels helpful for you.
No, it is. And when we were talking, also one thing that I hope is useful for other people too, using the support groups after and before surgery can be useful. But in my personal experience, it put a kind of gold standard or baseline that I was subconsciously measuring my healing towards. There are women, there are people that after surgery, they don't have any symptoms anymore. And God bless them. I'm truly happy for them. But there are so many pain generators that cannot be the definition of success, because it's not the experience that everyone. So yeah.
Yeah. That's really valuable. You know, I've been in this field for almost 25 years now. And because I never see the people that bounce right back after surgery, in my experience, it's much more always like this. So it's a wide range of responses. You know, you could have someone who's 19, who hasn't had a lot of symptoms yet, who have a less severe situation, and just taking the nail out of the foot quickly, taking that endometriosis out quickly, the body recovers more quickly on its own. And that happens. So I also want to put that potential out there, because for some people, and hey, you could even be 40 and that could happen for you. That does sometimes happen. And it's not a bad thing. And it doesn't mean the surgery wasn't a success if you still have work to do after. And it's part of, I think, the journey of life. You know, having lived with a chronic illness now, I really feel like part of the teaching of life is that we all have immense challenges of varying measure. You know, not just living with a chronic illness, but just being almost 50 years old. It's like, I don't know a single person personally.
That's like waking up every day. I'm feeling like, ooh, I'm Fiji. I'm Fiji again.
You know, and I know people who have moved to like Bali and it doesn't matter. Like you can't escape it. This is life. Like you could live in the perfect place and still have stress and pain and chronic illness and all of that. So the benefit is, it's like, once you've come through the surgery, now what we start looking at, okay, your vision is that you have more energy, that you wake up feeling good most of the time, that you can start re-engaging in life, choosing more with more focus or more discernment, your next level career, your next step career, you know, continuing to have a lot more fun with your partner and your friends and your family. And this is a great vision. And we do in coaching, we lead with that. So, you know, if I was working with you for months, we would spend a whole day just like building a vision board, building a vision journal, like really see that, because it's important to not just be running away from pain, but to be going towards something amazing and also having that thing right now. So today, you're feeling however you're feeling, and you're showing up here and doing some really skillful advocacy for absolutely anyone who listens to this podcast, which may be a part of the next step of your career journey, for example. Well, and so the other thing I was going to say is, and in that moment, you can also have a little more fun every day by like dressing a certain way or going to a museum, however you feel. Like you can have this in little bites too. It's not all or nothing.
Yeah. No, 100%. Now that I am where I am right now, I feel I don't want to do the positive psychology read on the journey, because I honestly, as a receiver of that, when I was in the midst of it, saying, oh, think positive, everything happens for a reason, it can be very triggering. What I'm going to say is that this pivot I had to make is one of the most meaningful things that has ever happened to me, because it kind of made me wake up to the fact that I am born to serve something with my passion that is closer to people's life. If I want, and if I wanted, I can go through the corporate ladder, make tons of money that I'm going to have to spend in tons of therapy, because in the end, I love the people I work with, but standing up for the invisibles, for example, has become a huge mission for me. I'm looking at advocacy position in different fields. And I'm also, after 1 year home, I started having like flowery business dresses. And maybe I try to like have my routine in the morning. It doesn't always work. Some days I just feel not good, but I feel in my body more when I take care of myself. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I agree with you. It's not always this triumphant story of coming through and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I absolutely don't think my chronic illness was the best thing that ever happened to me. I still think it's the worst thing that ever happened to me. And we can gather meaning, which is valuable, and we can gather sort of a sense of strength within ourselves. And, you know, all stories have some level of inspiration, no matter how challenging they were. So I agree with you. I think it's very important to not be like, this is great. No, this also sucks. That's okay.
Yeah. I mean, there are some, I don't know, especially on social media, there's sometimes some very cheap positive psychology that is not very rooted in how really the psychology of a person that's suffering and has chronic pain works. So I'm trying to stay away from that. But it's true. It can bring meaning.
Beautiful. Okay. So we have a clear meaning. We have a clear vision. And part of that is about improving your symptoms. So let's get into the physiology of the next levels of the systems. So the nervous system is then connected to the digestive and immune systems, which are very connected to each other. About 80% of our immune system is kind of wrapped in and around the digestive system. And for you, you've had a lot of endometriosis-related bloating, constipation, bowel pain, constipation, diarrhea, swings, that kind of thing, abdominal discomfort, and a lot of food sensitivities. So one of the things that has evolved in my practice, even since I wrote Outsmart Endometriosis, published about 4 years ago, is we used to do a lot more with elimination type diets to try to take away the foods that are causing irritation to the immune system. The problem with that is if you do that too aggressively, you make the nervous system afraid of foods unnecessarily. And so I take a much lighter handed approach. And I think that is kind of the direction in which you're going now in terms of your food journey. Can you share that with us just a little bit now?
Yeah, absolutely. So my journey really reflects what you are talking about, because in the past, I've been working with dietitians for IBS when I didn't know what I had. And it really helped me because at some point I was scared. I mean, I have a background of eating disorder when I was very young. So for me, the concept of diet is very triggering. But also, since I was having all these symptoms, I was eating four foods. So through working with a nutritionist, I got back to eating more foods, but my symptoms have been very erratic. So even when I was journaling and trying to find a culprit, it could really be that I ate the same thing. I was just sad one day, I was scared another day, or I was tense. So what I'm doing now, I've been reading tons, and also thanks to the classes in your courses, because I graduated as an endo coach. And so I really studied a lot. I really try to be very experiential. And if you talk to me about my diet, it's already very clean. So I don't drink, no caffeine. So like intuitively already, I've never had and I don't have any desire of the inflammatory foods per se. I am eating very little gluten. And I tried also to be completely gluten-free. And actually for my system, every single time I get super constipated. And it's probably because gluten-free products can be maybe more refined. I eat very little meat. I tried also to be fully vegan, but for my body, it doesn't work. So once a week meat, tons of veggies. I finally have been very courageous and reintroduced cruciferous that I was very scared of, but actually, and also lentils and beans. So I'm in the process of really, I don't want to put a goal around it. I'm not doing this because I want to become vegan in 6 months, but I am trying to explore sources of proteins that don't come only from meat, and fish is very good for me. And I cut sugar completely. Sugar for me, not the sugar in fruit, but any other refined sugar really like sends me to trigger land, become 6 months pregnant, bloated.
Yeah, bloating. Yeah. So in step three of our system, we take your story into account with equal weight to any lab testing we have, any wearable data we have. So whether it's your Fitbit that's showed you how to rest more, how to sleep more, how your recovery timeline is, when you need to take breaks, and you can do that with other Garmins, Oura Rings, Apple Watches, whatever you have. And then you have done four lab tests in the recent past. So one of them was an IgG food sensitivity test. And I want to talk about this a little bit. There's a little bit of data that shows that doing an IgG food sensitivity test is a useful guideline for an elimination diet that will give kind of the digestive and immune system a chance to rest and let the immune system be less overreactive to things it shouldn't be reactive to, which is essentially any food. Now, the problem with the food in the US more than in Italy, which is kind of interesting, is that we have more glyphosate, more chemicals, more processing. So sometimes eating foods in parts of Europe is less chemical laden than it is in the United States. And so that could be a piece of the puzzle in this particular case for sure. But there are also some foods that popped up as positive on your testing. Alfalfa, oddly enough, garlic, you know, there are these occasional ones. Garlic is a common trigger for bloating, you know, SIBO type things. And so is endo, which we'll get into in a minute. So I don't do IgG food sensitivity testing most of the time in our work, because what I find is that it just makes people afraid of things. But sometimes it can be valuable because you can say, okay, there's just a couple things on here that are really lit up. Let's give your system a break. And there is also some data that doing about 3 days of fasting, which I wouldn't do right off the bat. I would help people build up to that with like intermittent fasting and maybe 1 day a week fasting for a little while, or 1 day a month, or 1 day a quarter. And eventually 3 days can help the immune system stop overreacting to regular things like foods that it shouldn't be reacting to. Foods, dust, environmental allergens, pet hair, stuff like that. So one of the reasons we do a short-term elimination is to quiet down the immune system. So for you, it sounds like that was somewhat helpful, but the bigger thing was to not reactivate an eating disorder, which is essential, and to start getting your nervous system comfortable with expanding your foods. It's okay if you're a little bloated for a little while. You know, just starting getting comfortable, because when you heal your gut, there is a period of transition where sometimes you're going to go through some of that more bloating. We just need to keep it manageable for whatever that feels like for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Absolutely.
So that's one thing. So that's one lab test that can guide things. And then the other, from the gut standpoint, that we have here is Genova GIFX. This test, a GIFX, is a stool gut microbiome test. And the gut microbiome is such a key indicator in, there's a gut brain axis. So mood swings can come from bad balance of good and bad gut bacteria. Immune system is driven by the gut microbiome and your digestive processes. So this stool test was done to look at the gut microbiome, was done before her surgery, but let's still take a look at some of the impacts. So challenges with breaking down protein and fats, so with her digestive enzymes, increased inflammation, so increased secretory IgA, which is part of the immune system that lines the large intestine, gets really activated and inflamed. Not too bad. She's at a 4 out of 10, and with 10 being the worst in that circumstance. She's a 10 out of 10 for dysbiosis, which is a balance. So we've all heard of the gut microbiome. Inside of our, mostly our large intestine, but a little bit in the small intestine, there should be a whole huge colony of microbes, fungi, parasites, viruses, bacteria. We don't even know everything that's in there. That's supportive, unless there's too many that are more pathogenic, more problematic, and not enough of the beneficial ones. So it's about balance, and it's about where the gut microbiome is in the intestine. It should be mostly in the large intestine. For a lot of people with endo, it kind of creeps back into the small intestine, and we'll get into that in a second. That's where you get quote unquote endo belly, or SIBO, SIFO, you know, any of those acronyms, small intestinal bacterial or fungal overgrowth. And her bacterial overgrowth in the stool is not great. Really high yeast, SIBO, she's positive for SIBO. Her immune system is being somewhat suppressed because she doesn't have that really healthy, robust, beneficial bacteria, not really resilient beneficial bacteria. Her digestive enzymes are a bit low, which is why she's having trouble breaking down fats and proteins, inflammation in the lining of the large intestine, low short-chain fatty acids, which is the short-chain fatty acids are the metabolites, the things that the good bacteria create that help feed and heal the lining of the large intestine. So she's really low on that, including butyrate, which is one of those key short-term fatty acids, which feed the colonocytes or the cells that line the large intestine. And then beta-glucuronidase is pretty good. That's good. Sometimes that's elevated, which will keep recycling estrogen for people with estrogen dominance. She's not dealing with that. But what she's really dealing with is a not great composition of the bacteria in her large and small intestine, which is going to be problematic for both metabolism and not really infection per se, but an imbalance in the immune system's ability to fight things. So when the immune system gets constantly flared up and active against regular things like food and dust and dog hair, then you're always active, and not targeted. So if she gets some kind of bug, like a stomach bug or a viral infection, it's going to be harder for her immune system to get really focused and targeted and fight that off, because there's always this like cloud of inflammation. And that's where we're going. Or have you noticed anything like that in your life?
Yes, I noticed that last year when my symptoms became worse, and so my inflammation became much worse, especially when they put me on a mix of estrogens and progesterone, I was breaking out. Like, I never break out. I was breaking out on my skin. I was very inflamed in my bowel movement. My stomach was constantly inflamed, and I kept on getting sick. Like, I am really not a person that gets sick with respiratory bugs. And that last year, I got sick every single month. So I definitely noticed that when things got bad, my immune system was not there for me as it has always been. That's for sure.
Yeah. So it's overactive in some ways and underactive in some ways. So that's why we have to bring it back in balance. Now, one thing I want to quickly say about the endometriosis impact on the intestines. So many people have this bloating that you talked about. So there's only two ways for this bad bacteria to get into the small intestine. One is that when we eat food, it's not sterile, right? I mean, we don't like run our food through some kind of autoclave before we eat it. So we have to have good stomach acid to kill off the microbes that shouldn't be coming in, hitching a ride on our food. A lot of people, because they might have had heartburn for a long time or whatever, could have been on proton pump inhibitors, drugs, or other acid-reducing drugs. Anything like that in your past?
No. I have to say that after the surgery, since I was taking loads of anti-inflammatories, they gave me a low dose to protect the stomach. And I have to say that I'm experiencing once a week some heartburn, and that I never had before. And even I tried to use digestive enzymes, and they give me a terrible heartburn. So this is new, and it's the only time in my life that I used a proton inhibitor.
So we may need to start restoring good acid in the stomach, which will also better activate the enzymes that break down proteins. Because right now you're eating some animal protein, which is good for healing because we need some of those amino acids, but you're probably not breaking them down very efficiently. So they sit in the stomach and kind of ferment, and you end up with like bloating and gas, and they also just aren't broken down very well. And so they can then bring, because there's not enough acidity in the stomach, those bad microbes into the small intestine. So that's one thing that happens. And then the second thing that happens in endo is if you have endo on or around any of the intestines, which sounds like you did, even if it wasn't fully deeply infiltrating, you still get areas. If you think about the intestine, we want this nice, smooth peristalsis going consistently through. Yours is like patchy. And most people with endo have little pockets somewhere where things aren't moving as they should. And so that's another area where it's warm and slow and full of food, so bad bugs can grow, yeast in particular. And there's a little valve between the small and large intestine called the ileocecal valve. That, like I said, there's supposed to be a ton of really beneficial bacteria and some not so great bacteria in the large intestine. But if that door is stuck open or kinked a little from an endoadhesion or a post-surgical scar or anything like that, or just an endo lesion, that door can allow for the bad bacteria to then, or even the good bacteria in the wrong place, scooch up into the small intestine. And so that's why people feel so bloated. So with endometriosis, it's not so much that we just eradicate SIBO and SIFO and bloating with like one course of antibiotics or one course of antimicrobial herbs. It's that we manage the SIBO or SIFO with improving the stomach acid, which also can be benefited by mindful eating, chewing, slowing down when we eat, not eating, standing up in the car, you know, all of that, which again, I know you and everyone else listening to this can do that all the time, but more of the time. And then adding some stomach acid and digestive enzymes support in a way that's going to help with not cause more heartburn. And it may short term cause a little bit of heartburn, but we want to do it in collaboration with visceral physical therapy, which is a manual skills to help make sure your diaphragm is moving well, you know, just your chest area, your stomach, your small and large intestine, that ileocecal valve, because in that fascia is where some of that nervous system upregulation can happen when things get sticky and then the immune system gets hyperactivated and food is not moving through. And so the microbiome reacts negatively. So we use supplements for stomach acid, digestive enzymes, gut motility, and then pre and probiotics once all of that is moving better. But we can't start with any of this stuff until we've opened the windows and doors. And I know you've heard me say that before.
Yes. I love it. It works very well.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why you probably got so activated with adding hormones is that your body was not able to metabolize them well. We never want to add hormones, even perimenopausal hormone replacement therapy or menopausal hormone replacement therapy, without making sure that the lymph is flowing well. So the lymph is like your superficial circulatory system, which is very gentle and light, and it's kind of integrated in the fascia, and it's a system of moving fluid through the body, but it doesn't have pumps like the circulatory system, doesn't have the heart. So it's pumped by physical movement, you know, and all kinds of movement, rotational movement, full range of movement, flexibility, stability, strengthening, mobility, and gentle massage kinds of techniques, gua sha, lymph drainage massage. There's many, many ways to get it moving. But in most people with complex chronic illness, your lymph is sluggish. So we got to start there. And then we have to get the bowel moving because, again, you can't process the estrogen if it keeps getting recycled in the large intestine. So if you're having chronic, even mild constipation, I like to see my people who've been dealing with this level of sluggishness and toxicity having great bowel movements at least 2-3 times a day. Like 1-3 times a day is what we're looking for. And for most people, that takes some work. We've got to optimize a lot of different things, magnesium and everything else. How about you? What have you found to help that for you?
Yeah. So the thing with me is that I am a 1 or 2 bowel movement person per day. So people are like, you're not constipated. But actually, it's a functional constipation. I had to build an entire ritual around bowel movements now where I know that I'm going to be in child pose on the bathroom floor. And then it never gets out all at the same time. And it's more functional in my case. It's the organ that doesn't, sphincters, they don't coordinate always very. Magnesium is absolutely foundational. Like I always have magnesium at night before bed, and it changes my life. I also, in cycles, take a motility supplement that contains triphala and then other gentian. I don't take it all the time because I don't want to get too used to it, but it unblocks the situation for me. And then I also notice vitamin D. When I have good vitamin D and vitamin B as well, for me, vitamin B and B12 especially, I notice that I can go. My omega, like I've always seen lots of improvement in how I feel when I take omega-3s, fish oil. I mean, sometimes it gives me, like, especially lately, heartburn. So that's a supplementation that I'm not successful at keeping on taking constantly. But this is more or less my regime. And then in the morning, I take a thing called adrenal cocktail that contains, it's basically to recharge the ability of creating ATP and energy, but actually helps me with my bowels very much. So that's my personal regime that I use.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because it's hard to make vitamin B12 if your stomach isn't acidic enough. Vitamin D is difficult for everyone to keep at optimal levels, and it does help with that circadian rhythm. So I always say the bowel and the brain like rhythm. So those morning routines, some manual therapies for the motility. We might need to use some antimicrobials in your case because there is some strong data that killing off the yeast and bad bacteria, but then we've got to kind of get it out. So we don't do that until you're at least having decent bowel movements as you said, magnesium. We also sometimes use supplemental tools to support the vagus nerve to kind of have that morning stimulation that supports acetylcholine. There's a product called Parasym Plus. There's the motility supplements. So there's lots of different tools and you're using a lot of those. I think we would review that regimen, but overall that's good. Lymph support, bowel support, and then liver support. And again, we can use specific supplements for the liver, everything from milk thistle to castor oil packs, also helpful for bowel movements, you know, visceral massages to the liver. There are lots of homeopathics for the liver. That's really how I support liver, is just making sure things are moving. Breath work, making sure, and again, with endo, a lot of times people's breathing is off, their rib cage isn't moving well, there's not good rotation. People can have endo on the diaphragm, in the lungs, on the liver. So that liver support can mean a lot of different things. Do you have enough amino acids to support the liver? Do we have enough N-acetylcysteine, which has some great data on it behind for endo, taking it recently? That's a really good pre and post-op supplement too, because it helps stabilize any growth of new lesions or growth of lesions. So those three things, lymph, bowel, liver. And I also think about sweating and exhalation, that kind of day-to-day detox. Do you do anything for that?
So that's my goal. I definitely move and exercise every day. And also my yoga practice sometimes, it's definitely pretty active. I haven't been able to go back to my aerobic regime because many times I'm so fatigued. And I love dancing. And there is a class that it's my goal to go back in February, so this month. But it's 1 hour of like music, super loud, and go, 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 go. And many times I don't go because I don't have it in me. And so I'm trying now every couple of days to do 10 minutes of, he has videos available. So bringing aerobic back, that's the part that I think I miss the most. I mean, I realize, especially, I mean, taking your classes too, that yes, it was good for me a couple of years ago when I was going like 3 times a week, but also it was very stressful for my system. And so it's finding a good balance there.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that that's one example too of living the vision in the bite-sized amount that you can do now. That's perfect. So that's really fun. Again, sweat, movement, and we have to be mindful, of course, of what you just said, the adrenals. So that brings us to, and so some of the things you're intuitively doing with your diet. So it's generally clean, which is good. Caffeine, alcohol. Sometimes caffeine is beneficial for people with endo because it kind of gets the morning rhythm going. I don't over or underemphasize it. It just kind of depends on work. You know, people who love their coffee, fine. One cup of coffee at the same time every day can be valuable. People who don't care and feel better without it, also fine. And so we get that morning rhythm going. And now you're talking about, you know, eating fish for protein, which again is going to be harder. Fish and meat are great sources of protein, most bioavailable, eggs too. But they have to be able to be broken down by the stomach, which is hard when we have by the digestive enzymes. So we need enough acidity. We need enough digestive enzymes, which her situation is low in, but we can't just throw all of that at it. We have to be gentle to it. We have to create the space. We have to make sure there's good lymph and movement and all of that. So you're on the path. And what nourishes the butyrate producing bacteria, which we want. So we want to kill off some, which I like to do with a pulsed herbal strategy. So we use pulsed antimicrobial herbs every couple of weeks to, you know, we might do it for 3 months as a loading dose and then maybe once a quarter or once a month or for a few weeks on, a few weeks off. Just depends, you know, given however that person's body responds and how well we're doing all of the other things. And once we start that, I also like to layer in pre and probiotic foods, which intuitively you're starting to do more of anyway, more lentils, more cooked cruciferous broths to help the lining of the intestine, glutamines, zinc. So there's lots of tools we can do to really nourish that digestive tract. And I like to do as much of that with slowly adding good things to the diet. So the diet feels much more delicious and expansive and flexible and all of that. So great news on the digestive front. Now shifting gears to the hormones, which are still related. As you said, if you're exhausted in the morning or you have way too much estrogen or way too much progesterone, the gut is also going to slow down. So we always support the hormone system by supporting the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis. So on your Dutch test here, your HPA axis, when you wake up, your cortisol is super low. So of course you feel exhausted. We want that ideally to be in kind of the top third of the range. So you wake up with that little morning kick, burst of cortisol. If you need it from your coffee, you're probably not getting it from your hormones. So we think about brain inflammation. We think about rhythm. We think about sleep quality. And we think about adrenal supports. And there's adrenal support herbs. There's vitamin C. There's optimizing salt balance. Another thing that's very common for people with endometriosis is to struggle with a trifecta of mast cell activation. So you're a little sensitive to a lot of things. That's that immune overactivity and hypermobility and dysautonomia. So we have to be careful with yoga of overstretching joints instead of muscles. And we have to be careful of our blood pressure can be a little bit all over the place. Our like reactivity can be a little bit off in terms of those autonomic issues. So that's probably why in the morning you feel better with what's known kind of on TikTok and on social media is the adrenal cocktail. So the adrenal cocktail is essentially vitamin C, which supports the adrenal function, with salt and fluid. And that can, you know, be water, it can be juice, something that tastes good. But the reason we do that is because that salt water in the morning gets you rehydrated in a way that helps maintain the autonomic function. So that should continue to help. How do you feel in the morning when you do that?
I mean, I'm not going to say I get the kick if I get caffeine, okay? But I feel more energetic when I exercise. So it took a while because the first few weeks I could really feel my bowels like gargling all the time. I just feel it makes things move. Instead of feeling sluggish, I feel my bowels are making those little noises. So it makes me feel definitely better. Is it every day? No, but overall, as a trend, I notice a difference.
So that's really good. And then we can use some adrenal support adaptogens. So those are herbs that help kind of modulate our energy. And we can use things that support the mitochondria. That's things like CoQ10, PQQ, the N-acetylcysteine and the glutathione to help with gentle detox for the whole system so it's not overstrained. There are other micronutrients that support the mitochondrial function, like certain B vitamins, nicotinamide mononucleotide, and then all of the antioxidants, which are those colorful things in fruits and vegetables. What makes fruits and vegetables colorful? Things like resveratrol and lutein and all of that, that we mostly want to get from food. But, you know, in some cases, we do need supplementation support. So mitochondrial support, adrenal support. So your morning adrenals are tanked, but the good news is the cortisol curve increases normally with kind of the morning wake up and get moving. So you are kind of feeling more restored a few hours in, and then it falls off a cliff again around dinner time.
Dad,
we're like, oh, somebody make me food, which again, this test was done pre-op, but still, it might be even more tired now. So when your cortisol is down, you're going to feel tired. So that's when we build in some support network for what's your web of support around getting someone to help with dinner time meal prep or that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. In our home, roles are not attached to gender. So even if I'm from Italy, I'm not the one that loves to cook here. So I definitely have a great support system when I am exhausted at night and very lucky about that.
Good, good. That's really important. And then it does perk up a little bit right before bed, but not so high that you can't fall asleep. We definitely want to dive into sleep, but I want to slowly start wrapping up just because, you know, we've gone on for a while, and then we'll continue as needed after this. So in the hormone piece of the step four, where we're kind of pulling in the data. So step three, we're looking at all the data. Step four, we're thinking about next step. And step five, we put it into a schedule. So you can actually start doing these things relatively consistently and with your scientific mind, begin to execute and see how your body is responding to not too many changes at once. So we're also seeing relatively normal progesterone at this point, and you have the IUD, low estrogen, which can be kind of okay in the short term, given that we're trying to recover from endo, but I can understand why your libido may be all over the place, why your mood is a bit all over the place. You know, there's a lot contributing to that regarding estrogen modulation of metabolism in the brain. So that it can also put you in a kind of short-term premenopausal state, which makes your libido go down, which makes your metabolism, your insulin resistance a bit higher, which can make you gain weight. And so the IUD is a good short-term solution for kind of mitigating or minimizing any new endometriosis post-op. But it's just kind of a way to stabilize the system for the short term from too much fluctuation, but it may not be a good long-term strategy. One thing we didn't talk about in your case is fertility. Do you have any particular fertility goals?
No.
Okay.
So on that, I'm happy that I feel this way because I'm not concerned about that.
Okay. And again, that's something for your listening, for our clients to take into consideration, because in that case, we want to do excision surgery as soon as possible to more optimize fertility options. But also that first year post-op, there is some good data that shows that some of the immune markers drop off, which make it more successful in terms of fertility optimization. And so if women are relatively younger, having early excision with all of this work done really aggressively around that pre and post-op time frame, which, you know, could take a year, 2 years, it can happen within that. But that's when we get a little help from the system dropping the immune hyperreactivity, which can cause infertility as well. So overall, I think from a hormone standpoint, since you reacted so poorly to taking a hormone, my goal for you and with you would be to eventually help you no longer need the IUD. But we want to make sure those windows and doors are really open and moving, and that you're nourished enough. Because you're only 41, your body should be able to make all these hormones. You still have your ovaries, you still have your uterus, but there has been a lot of like physiologic trauma to them between the scarring and the surgery and all of that. So we use everything from peptide bioregulators, which help kind of re-nourish the organs, to just making sure your body's absorbing amino acids. So you're getting enough protein from any number of sources, that your digestion is working. Kind of your root cause, I would say, at the moment is that intersection between the digestion, immune, and nervous systems. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it does. It's definitely the hotter spot for me at the moment.
Yeah. All right. So let's come up with a quick kind of first step plan that you can do in your day. So given everything that you've said, you've got this supportive environment, you have a little more time and space to heal, and it's so pivotal that you're nourishing your immune nervous system and your whole body nervous system, not just your brain and your digestion. So we wake up in the morning, we're a little tired. What feels like the first good thing for you to do? And some options, if I'm putting my coaching education hat on: step outside with a warm glass of electrolyte water, your adrenal cocktail, do some journaling, do some morning movement, have a cup of tea with maybe light caffeine to get your bowels moving, take a walk. So there's lots of options. What feels like a good start for you?
For me, I think waking up and making the adrenal cocktail, drink some of it, and then going out within the first half an hour that I am up, to have a little, even if it's 15 minutes, but walking does wonders. and then coming in for at least a 15 minutes exercise. It can be anything. If I am very tired, it can be like fascia flossing, stretching, or it can be a yoga session, or it can be some dancing. But definitely within the first hour that I am awake, moving. If I don't move, it's guaranteed I become very like...
Yeah. So that's beautiful. So you've got your movement, you've got nature, you've got sunlight, which resets the circadian rhythm and keeps that nervous system rhythm moving. You have a little adrenal nourishment in the morning. Then I would recommend relatively early, because of your HPA axis weakness, that we start supporting your digestion with either betaine HCl, some more direct stomach acid support, or apple cider vinegar that's diluted. Good chewing, good mindful eating, and your largest meal being breakfast. So I like to say to my clients, you know, dinner for breakfast rather than breakfast for dinner. So that's when you'll have your largest protein heavy meal, and we can do more of the targeted supplementation, digestive enzymes, maybe some probiotics, prebiotics, prebiotic and probiotic food for sure. Protein, possibly those peptide bioregulators, and some pre and probiotic fiber. So vegetables, whole grains, beans, you know, and these can be rotated recipes that we can support. So I think, you know, we'll start there with a morning routine, focusing on the digestion, the bowel function, nervous system settling. And then often what I'll do is layer in more things through the day as we go. How does that feel for you?
No, it sounds great.
Okay, great.
It feels feasible too. So that's also an added.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you're in this visioning moment too, where you're starting to think about what your next job will be in the next 6 months to a year. So it can help you design what kind of schedule you need for the job to fit into, rather than trying to fit your life into your work schedule. Okay. So we've got that scheduling. And then the last two pieces are, one is the support network to make it happen. And we've talked about that in your case a little bit. So everyone think about, you know, who's making you dinner? What might you have to change financially? One thing I had to do years and years ago, with the first time I dealt with chronic illness, was I needed to take 2 years off of work. And that required us to move and to downsize quite a bit and go to a place that wasn't the perfect place for me, but where my husband could work. So, you know, sometimes we have to take bigger jumps. In your case, you know, you're maybe able to stay in the same place, but your partner is taking on more of the financial weight. So, you know, that's part of the ebb and flow of life too. Anything else you want to say about that?
No, it's definitely, I really noticed a huge improvement of my mental health when I prioritize connection. In the last 6 months, I went from there's no yoga studio in the area to finally finding a yoga studio and just having community, even if they're not cooking for me, or it's not that they're delivering, but the connection, it gets you out of that free state very much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's two really, really evidence-based things in terms of lifestyle and medicine and whole human health. And those are connection with other humans, any safe spaces, any safe people in conversation, and exercise. That's it. So that's so valuable. So you found that, that's key. And then the next thing we think about as we kind of continue the circle is like, what is your next set of goals? But for now, I think there's plenty of work to do in this awareness of where the real challenging piece of the physiologic puzzle is: digestive, immune, nervous. You've got lots of tools. You've got an initial morning routine. And then, you know, normally what I would say is, let's meet in a month and we'll see how it's going.
That sounds great.
Excellent. All right. Anything else you want to share before we wrap up today?
No, I think it was great, because in this session, we really went through so many different levels that sometimes you explore with different practitioners. And so I think tying things up, I don't know, it makes more sense. It gives more sense to everything that's happening.
Yeah. And I think that's such a valuable insight, because it's almost always the case with any complex chronic illness that you're going to have a team. I'm not going to be the expert in everything. I'm certainly not an excision surgeon. And so for our practitioners who are doing this work, your work, when you take a coaching-led mindset, is often to help people tie together and prioritize the recommendations and insights that they've gained from their whole team of professionals in alignment with their goals, not so much the goals necessarily of their other professionals. So,
yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for sharing. Thank you for spending so much time with us today. And I hope this was really valuable for you.
It was. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow, that was such a wonderful conversation. And I think what I most want you to take away from it is that how we integrate working with the client and her vision and her goals and her priority challenges in a situation where everyone's nervous system is being constantly regulated, yours and your client's, is your fastest path to helping them integrate such a complexity and to making it easy and doable and able to be specifically supported by their web of support. So when your clients leave their appointment with you, the most important thing is that they feel like they are on the path and that they are beginning to live their vision now. Because healing and living with complex chronic illness is a multi-month, multi-year, multi-decade experience. And for people with endometriosis, you know, as far as we are aware at this time, they will always have this underlying vulnerability. So we want to fit in to their lives what it means to be healthy at this moment and how that can continue to expand. And then I hope you learned some unique specifics about how endometriosis impacts the nervous, digestive, and immune and endocrine systems so that we can help people really heal physiologically from those root causes that are well connected to their emotional health, their spiritual health, and their community health. So again, I thank Federica so much, and I hope that this episode will really inform your practice to start thinking in a coaching mindset, even if you are working in a clinical setting. I'll see you next time. Thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of the Integrative Women's Health Podcast. Please share this episode with a colleague. And if you loved it, hit that subscribe or follow button on your favorite podcast streaming service so that we can do even more to make this podcast better for you and your clients. Let's innovate and integrate in the world of women's health.